sit in contemplation of the human situation. I often feel a certain sense of pride, for our achievements are many and mighty, and the evidence cannot be denied. But my reverie is shaken, 'cause my thoughts are always taken to a tragedy that happened long ago, when there moved through the land beings awesome and grand. The fabulous dinosaur, they were creatures in a manner quite reptilian, in their unique and stylish way. And their numbers could be reckoned in the millions, but there are zero of these heroes in the world today. They had music, art, and fashion. They had dinosauric passion. And I think they'd be enraged and mortified that when they're mentioned today, it's only to say their brains were small and they died. Perhaps some asteroid that Mother Earth could not avoid became the agent of their premature demise. Well, I understand these things can happen, so who are we to criticize when we'll pay most any price to have the ultimate device that will ensure the perfect global suicide? I would venture instead that the humanoid head is where the tinier brain resides. And when we're gone, our works will start to crumble until nothing can be found. In 10 million years, some other guys may stumble on our fossils, and some fellow will begin to expound in some scientific study to his cockroach science buddy, the evidence could never be denied. They were big, dumb, and slow. They couldn't go with the flow. Their brains were small and they died.
Thank you. I'm aware of trying to measure my own brain size right at the moment. Oh my. My brother came up to visit from Georgia and said, "So what are you preaching on this Sunday?" And I said, "Evil and evolution." And he started laughing because he's a scientist. And he said, "So you're going to go find out when the first cell that had an evil intent started duplicating itself and getting, you know," it's like. So the topic, the brother and sister dynamic notwithstanding, the topic jumped out at me as kind of riveting in reading Krista Tippett in particular. She wrote this book on becoming wise. And one of the things that she talks about is the fact that our human brains, we use so little of our human brains, and our experiment of living in larger and larger collections in societies is such a young experiment that it's truly possible that we could find ways to use parts of our brains and live in community using the principles we find so dear, that are so important to us. And so the idea of evolving concept of sin was important to me. And so I started doing some research. One of the things to think about is that song, that hymn that we sang, "Let Nothing Evil cross this door, and that it was such a well-loved hymn for such a long time. And I don't know how many of you felt comfort in singing, in there's some sense of comfort, yeah, that we do create here quite intentionally as much of a sense of enough safety for us to tell our truth and to be beloved of one another, to learn to live with kindness and with love with one another. That is an intention. And so, especially nowadays, when it's feeling very different out in the world, from my perspective, it's not just okay, but it is right. It's good work for us to be creating this community together. But it's uncomfortable for me as well, because it so quickly, I was raised Methodist, and there were many images of Satan and evil and people who did not believe us the way we believed were, you know, somehow affected by Satan. And I just totally rejected all that, as many of you do. So the discomfort in the hymn has to do with a sense of evil being out there while we live with love in here. That it makes it too easy to forget where evil comes from if you accept the concept that there is evil. And we'll talk about that some more. So one of the congregations that I served in my early ministry had stored in its attic a sign that they used out in the front of their church back in the 1800s. It was that old of a congregation. And the church, that sign referred to the guidance of Jesus and the inevitable brotherhood of humanity. It was more than a footnote for all of us in that church to wonder if people of color or women had been in the leadership at the time that was a claim, because those individuals, those communities were feeling progress quite squelched. But the leaders of that community grabbing onto a faith that was seen as heretical, that denied the idea of original sin and that there was a Satan, that or that there was even a hell. That was our origin story as Unitarians and Universalists. Claiming that was exhilarating, very exhilarating. And so the sense was that there might be an inevitability about our human ability to keep ascending towards compassionate community. And then came the Depression, the World Wars, the rise of fascism, and they brought the sign inside. They brought the sign inside. David Robinson is an historian. He wrote this book on the bottom. Thus began the dark night of the soul of the Unitarian faith. And reading on, in that moment of history comes Frederick May Elliott. He's one of the Unitarian Unitarian ministers who took leadership presidency of the American Unitarian Association from 1837 to 1958. So Frederick May Elliott led the Unitarian side of our faith community into a rebirth of sorts. He wrote, "Only when there is a sincere recognition of the incompleteness and failure, only where there is a recovery of depth, breadth, and length, only there is the authentic spirit of religious liberalism to be found." Remembering that religious liberalism is not at all connected to political liberalism. Liberal faith has to do with accepting all the information to find what is true. Science, art, psychology, all of it, and figuring out for ourselves what is true. What do we understand to be the ground of all being based on all of that? So he said, that idealism, grounded in positive faith in man, but an idealism that is neither romantic nor naive, is the kind of idealism that we need to work for. And he said that knowing that liberal faith, human beings, the human effort can fail and fail miserably. Love does lose in the public square. There's a saying about liberal faith. Liberal faith is dead. Long live liberal faith. It's actually liberalism is dead. Long live liberalism. But the tendency in this political atmosphere to think that we're talking about the liberal side, quote unquote, of the debate is too interesting to go with. So liberal faith is what was intended. Liberal faith is dead. Long live liberal faith. What's meant by that is when our ideals and our beliefs fall short of reality because we look out to reality for our test of faith. When our beliefs fall short of reality, then we have to reevaluate with self-examination, an uncompromising look at the facts around us and in us. And for a long time, Unitarian Universalist ministers and writers didn't focus a lot on evil, except in our commitment to work to transform with our human minds and hands and love what the idea of evil points to. We wanted to change ourselves and the world for better, and that was enough. And then 9/11 happened. And I found myself on that Sunday morning needing to talk about evil because that is the concept that our culture was falling back on. That was the concept that members of my congregation were falling back on. Not that just there is evil in the world, but they are evil. That whole faith is evil. There was that overwhelming reaction to such violence. I found myself focusing on the topic. More than a few people got angry when I didn't label those who flew the planes into our people as evil. I affirmed that the violence had to be stopped. I prayed for the dead and the suffering. I called for deep self-examination to learn how this country was linked to the suffering that made such violence so absolute and terrifyingly effective then and now. It was a dark night of the soul of our country, and I felt we had to resist simplistic reactions, had to go deep and wide and long to see where we had failed, where our beliefs had failed, where our meaning system has failed. And to rebirth a faith that was grounded in the facts and in love. At the precipice of this particular election, and I know you're all going out to vote, at the precipice of this election, I'm feeling the same way. The evil outside these walls feels overwhelming to many of us. It is critical. And it is right and good that we build a community inside these beautiful walls that is grounded in facts and faith and in the potential and power of loving covenant, of commitment to self-examination and growth. And it's too tempting to look out there to find the targets we can label as evil or not of us, them. So I ask all of us, and I have to keep working in myself to resist that. Instead, to go deep and wide and long, figure out whether and how we are related to what is happening with the words and actions that they are examples of what we might think of as evil. And then we reclaim our commitment to loving community. I was not thinking about the election when I agreed to this topic, but it's hard not to incorporate it now. So here's what I'm thinking about evil based on a whole lot of reading I did and settling on these particular authors. Krista Tippett is, some of you know, a person who studied religion and was a journalist, and now works with the National Public Radio on a series of interviews called On Being. That is on, I said National Public Radio. She interviews people like Thich Nhat Hanh, Bishop Tutu, Dalai Lama, and many people we've never heard of who, from her understanding, have learned something about how to live with wisdom in this life. And she has interviewed many hundreds of people of many, many different faiths and without faiths. So I was riveted by her words that sin is a piece of psychological clarity. It's helpful in humans, as we humans tend to orient toward numbness and avoiding our reckoning. Perhaps sin is the ingrained lure of going numb. I'll read it again. Sin is a piece of psychological clarity. Helpful in humans as we tend to orient toward numbness and avoiding reckoning. And perhaps sin is the ingrained lure of going numb. And she talks about the repository of spiritual tools. She calls them spiritual technologies that exist in religious traditions around the world, because religious organizations and traditions have been in the conversation about how to live with their values, our values, for millennia, for centuries. And there's conversation that continues about how is it we value the individual and the community and what we understand to be the undergirding truth of life, the sacred ground of being. How do we do that complex thing? And so she sees, as many religious mentors see, that traditions unleashed from the ways that we get calcified in our thinking, some of those spiritual technologies can and do help us live our beliefs in the world. And so, my goodness, as I think about the concept of evil that was built into religions as a way to signal that we must use our spiritual technologies to live our beliefs, it changes everything somehow for me. I did not believe that there is a Satan. I do not accept that there is a hell. And yet, the concept of sin and evil as ways for us to be aware so that we can recruit the spiritual technologies we know to become our better selves makes so much sense to me. Huh. Pico Iyer is one of the people that Krista Tippett interviews. And he's an atheist. And he talks about studying spirituality as the story of the human passionate affair with what is deepest inside of us. Huh. I don't think that excludes any of us. Spirituality is the story of our passionate affair with what is deepest inside of us. And religion is the community, the framework, and the tradition into which we bring what we find deep inside, and where we learn more about how we want to orient ourselves deep inside. So religion has the capacity around the world to recruit for the greater good, to use the idea of evil to recruit spiritual technologies. Okay. But I also know, as you do, that institutions get calcified. The brilliance, the inspiration that created the religious impulse to begin with, once it's institutionalized, can calcify and can get ungrounded in truth and in the current reality. We know this. It gets brittle. Then many traditions stop questioning. When most of the religious traditions started from a place of questioning, a stroke of inspiration, a genius that then became calcified. Our Unitarian Universalist faith is designed to stay in tension around questioning, to resist calcifying, to keep learning truths that we may not think are relevant or that we shove aside because that's not our way of orienting in the world, right? Okay. We Unitarian Universalists claim truth, growth, and love as primary guideposts. Truth, growth, personal growth, and growth of our larger communities, and love. The failure of our beliefs and our faith become an opportunity to figure out again what's true, what is not love, and focus again on love and living our principles for personal growth and greater good. So here's another concept. David Sloan Wilson is an evolutionary biologist who studies religion as well. What he has seen through time is as humanity started in smaller groups and then built the capacity to be in larger groups, that it was critical to have grains of thought that could coalesce to support those larger groups, right? So groups that don't agree with each other or who have very foreign ideas about what it means to be in community have a very hard time being together, and so they stay separate tribes. As the United Nations, for instance, works year after year after year to build a broader way of thinking about the world, a more common way, a more common understanding of what it means to be living for the greater good, working for the greater good. That is, in his understanding, a progression, a natural progression towards coalescing those thoughts in ways that support larger community. And he also says that fundamentalism is a reaction to that natural evolution. So in human communities, as we rub against each other's ideas and learn from each other and grow from each other, the idea that he's presenting us is that the more able we are to stand on common ground with one another and how we think allows us to be in a larger community. And that, in fact, it's happening on a global level. With so much tearing us apart in the world, can we take a minute to think about whether you see that anywhere? Do you see the possibility of thoughts coalescing at larger and larger levels in ways that will help us be together in larger community? Think about it for a minute. Do you see that happening? Krista Tippett has interviewed many, many young adults who are wild with a sense of spiritual reawakening and inspiration. And she is seeing that there is a growing resistance among young adults to the tamping down of thinking. I'm not finding the right words, but a resistance to the what we would see as the negative aspects of religion, while at the same time claiming the positive. And they're reinventing that the millennials all over the globe are reframing their religious traditions and challenging their churches to be churches or their temples to be temples or their communities to be loving community. And think of Occupy Wall Street. Same heart was the group of young people who went down to, I think it was New Orleans, after the hurricane. They were there with resources before anybody else was. And they were like banging on the doors of the churches saying, act like a church. Support the people. So I that's just one example. The United Nations is another. I guess I'm going to put this out as a challenge to you. In such a negative time, overwhelmingly negative sometimes, do the work to find out where those positive, inspiring threads are, because they're there. They're part of the story. They're part of the truth about what's happening now. David Sloan Wilson says, if your meaning system does not cause you to act in the right way, then it is not very good as a meaning system. And what we're seeing is, in an evolutionary kind of way, many religious traditions are having breakoffs of people who are saying just that. This tradition I love is not living its beliefs. We're gonna do something different. There's another example which blew me away, which is that in southern Italy, there are a group of activists. They see themselves as peace activists, activists for equity. They're hackers. They use technology as their primary tool of activism. They live in southern Italy, and they wanted to make sure, even though they're essentially anarchistic, they wanted to make sure they lived their beliefs. And so they've taken the rule of Saint Benedictine as their guidelines for living a community, an ancient rule, the rule that got much of humanity through the Middle Ages, through the Dark Ages, with education intact, with writing available still as a skill. So we need to open up our eyes to other things that are evolving in our culture, as well as what we're feeling overwhelmed by as terribly, terribly negative. So, gosh, if fundamentalism is a reaction to that evolutionary process, and it makes sense to us that it is, you think, wow, no wonder we're having such reactionary activity in our culture after 8 years of a black president. That in a culture that was created as a racist system, to have that kind of a backlash makes complete sense, as horrible as it is to witness. But there's also truth in some of the reactivity that we're seeing, and what we're being pushed to do is to, instead of looking out there and seeing evil, look again, find out where the failures in covenant have been, where the failures of love have been, where the failure of compassion is, where the misuse of power is. We know it's all there. And then we're challenged to figure out our relationship to those things, ground ourselves in our principles and our commitment to love, and then grow. Deepen, act, commit again. Liberal faith is dead. Long live liberal faith. Krista Tippett says, the human condition in all its mess and glory remains the ground on which all of our ambitions flourish and crash. History always repeats itself until we honestly and searchingly know ourselves. We create transformative, resilient, new realities by becoming transformed, resilient people. She continues by saying, this is about the lover as well as the beloved, the citizen as well as the politician, the social entrepreneur as well as the person in need. It means me and it means you. And so there are many, many, many more ways to talk about this, but I would like to stop knowing that there's a real richness of thought and experience in this room that we want to hear. So what I'm going to ask is that we take a moment, just if you'd like, close your eyes or just look out the windows, breathe, reclaim for yourself what you know or what you would like to think more about. And then I'm going to invite us to sing Spirit of Life, because this is, through surveys, one of the most favored hymns among Unitarian Universalists. It's a truth about who we are as a community. It's part of our meaning system. And so, page 123, Spirit of Life. Please rise, embody your spirit as you are willing or able.